First of all, Dominic, thank you for being here. We're super grateful to have you at Netherhall. And I'll give Dominic a brief introduction. So Dominic is currently the chairman of Rio Tinto, Leapfrog Investments, among many other things. Some of you might, who have read his bio might have seen that he was the global managing partner of McKinsey. Was McKinsey at 30 years or something?
Yeah.
So, and I read somewhere that you, during your time at McKinsey, you spent, you met two leaders, your rule was to meet two leaders a day.
Yeah.
So you can imagine, like, over the years, the wealth of kind of knowledge from working with all of these leaders. So I'm sure we'll get to that today. So I thought today it would be interesting to kind of split this into two parts. One is just getting to know you a bit better, but then also the second part being kind of a Q&A, because I think people here are very... I've had many questions already for people that wanted to ask you questions. Does that sound good?
Perfect.
Great. Yeah. Awesome. So to start off, I think it would be good for you to maybe just give a bit of background around, because many people here might not know that you grew up in Uganda.
Yeah.
And you have a story with, like, Idi Amin, right? Like,
yeah.
The general at the time. So could you share a bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's wonderful to be here, and just the mix of the backgrounds and what you guys are doing is amazing. So it's thank you for having me. And it's also good to, I didn't know about this place.
Yeah.
So it's good to see that this place exists and what you do, and also the history, getting a bit of a sense of that. It was very nice. I grew up, I was born in Uganda. I lived there for 7 years, from 1962 to 69. My dad was a missionary in the Anglican Church, and my mom was a nurse. And so we lived in a little town outside of Kampala called Mukono. And I remember it quite vividly because you know, the colors, the smells, everything. And I try and go back regularly to Uganda when I can. I definitely feel like it's a part of my home, if you will. But yeah, the Idi Amin thing was more, it's a bit of a sad story, obviously, with Idi Amin, because he was a person who was actually a well-regarded military leader. People wondered if he was corrupt or not, but he was seen as a well-regarded leader. And there were sort of, they called it guerrillas, but I have to differentiate. They were not guerrillas, they were terrorists in the jungle. Our house literally was, there was a wall of jungle, right? And they were in there. And so he took over our house for 3 days. The army came in and basically said, this is our place for now. And remember, we all moved into my bedroom. I didn't agree.
How did you feel about that?
I didn't. I said, I didn't agree with it. I remember my dad said, there's no, you know, this is how it will be. But Idi Amin had this amazing Land Rover, which I've always loved Land Rovers ever since. And it was a Land Rover. He would park right sort of in the middle of a U-shaped driveway. So during the day, I would play in the back of the Land Rover. And I was told by my dad not to do that, not to go near it. But I'd pretend I was driving the Land Rover. And one day the Land Rover started taking off, right, driving. And it was Idi Amin driving.
And
it.
You were in the...
I was in the back.
In the back.
And I remember I said... I wasn't wearing a shirt, just shorts. And I hid for the first, because I knew I wasn't supposed to be in it. And then I realized that's probably not a good idea because we're moving further and further away. So I banged on there was a glass window. So I banged on the glass, cut a long story short. I remember maybe as a kid, this huge head with big white teeth, like and looking at, and he pulled over. I'll remember this vividly. He picked me up by my shorts, like just literally picked me up, put me in the front seat. I remember I couldn't really see over the edge, and he was just this huge guy, right? Big and a very, like a beautifully pressed uniform. That's what he drove back, and we got there. My parents were obviously panicking. They didn't know where I was, and they pulled up. I think they could see my blonde, it wasn't white hair then, it was blonde, and it started sticking up, and I could see my dad looking, and then he basically went around the front of the Land Rover, picked me up again by my shorts, and then and said, you should be careful where your son plays, and then dropped him, and then me, and then sort of I went off. And what I remember, I have a Ugandan passport, which I got from the president, and he knew this story. He said, you know, you're probably the only person who can say that you were saved by Idi Amin. See, you said... But anyhow, yeah, so that was the beginnings.
So how long did you spend in Uganda, and then when did you go to Canada?
So I was 7 years in Uganda, and then we moved to Toronto briefly.
Yeah.
Because my dad was coming back, and then we went out to Western Canada, to British Columbia, sort of in the Fraser Valley. I was actually just there for the last 10 days, and it's very rural. It's rural Canada. It's like you go there, it just smells like cow manure everywhere. Yeah. Like I was shocked. I forgot what that was like, right? And there's like a plowing competition that I went to, and it was 60 miles outside of Vancouver. Mm. Bit of a farming area. And that's kind of where I grew up. And going to Vancouver was a big deal. Like if we'd go to Vancouver as a family, maybe twice a year, that was a huge deal. Like that was like, wow. Mm. So it was a very, but it was a wonderful community that I grew, amazing teachers, luckily, that we had. I was in a high school there, but just, we had amazing teachers that kind of were people that said you can do what you want, you do what you don't be constrained, do it, which was very important actually later on in life. So it was a good foundation. It was probably a very boring foundation, if I might call it that. I was quite bored. I did a lot because there just wasn't a lot to do. And most people stayed in, they didn't leave, if you will. And then I went to UBC, I went to university, and I was very worried. I thought, you know, I've come from a school that's like a rural public school. What's it going to be like? And it luckily turned out it was okay. There were very good teachers, so we were well prepared. And then I just kind of went, I got involved in tons of different things, sports. There was a program for basically children that didn't have fathers that you do. So that was like a sort of a giving program. There was a BC Youth Parliament. There was a whole range of different. So I just found it. I loved it. There was so many things to do. So anyway, I'm boring you probably with that's sort of the start. And then I really didn't know what I wanted to do, right? That was the problem. I don't know how you, I just had no idea what, I had no idea. I wanted to be an airplane pilot. I wanted to be a radio announcer. I used to study the cockpit of 747s in my bedroom. I had the cockpit laid out. I was trying to memorize where all the dials were. but I just didn't have a sense of what I could do, if you know what I mean. Like what job could I have? I was very worried about that. Mm-hmm. I was very, very nervous about, will I be able to get a job? How will I? Because I come from a family that didn't have very much money at all. Yeah. And it was literally, you know, if you want to go to university, that's great. They're very, but you know, if you can't pay for it, you're not going.
Yeah.
Like it's up to you. And that was a shocker to me. So I did very menial jobs I worked in a sawmill. It's basically a floor sweeper, machine equipment cleaner, which luckily paid very well, but it was in way up in the north, eastern part of British Columbia. I built roads, the road going from British Columbia into the Yukon. I sort of helped build that road. And I worked on a salmon fishing boat going all up and down the coast of British Columbia. So they were very, I didn't have any experience with CEO. I didn't even know what they were. I didn't, you know, it was more, I was operating with shop stewards, like with workers. That's who. So I actually was, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought, you know, I liked school in a way, like, so, and I did pretty well. So I thought, okay, maybe academia, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't sure. And then I had a course once that I had to take in the summer. It was a political science course, and from a remote, it was like a virtual. This is before the internet, right? So you'd mail in, be given books and an essay, and you'd write and you'd mail the stuff. And I loved it. I really liked the professor, even though I only met him on the phone. Mm. And we actually built a very good relationship. And he said to me at one point, he said, you know, look, I think you should apply for the Rhodes Scholarship. You know, I think you can. I said, what is that? I have no idea what that is. He goes, that's a program. If you do that, you can go to the UK, you're at Oxford, it'll be a good, you should, and I said, well, I, you know, he says, I've looked at your background, you should give it a shot.
Yeah.
And it was that guy that sort of got me to do that, but I didn't really know what I, you know what I mean? So that was sort of how I sort of left Canada for the first time.
And yeah. And how did you start thinking about even consulting? Like, how did that whole thing
idea what consulting
come about?
I'd honestly, in fact, when I first heard about it, I'll just tell you, there were many so then when I was at Oxford, again, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I applied for a lot of jobs that I didn't get. So I thought, maybe the World Bank sounds interesting or the IMF. I didn't even get a letter back. Mm. Nothing. Like, silence.
I want to pause there because I think there's like that's an important lesson, actually, because I think many people here, they see where you are now or all the things that you've done, but they don't realize that actually behind all of these successful journeys, there's like a lot of obstacles that come into play. There's a lot of failure. So I had no idea, like the former global managing partner, McKinsey, failed.
Yeah, many times. Many times I failed.
No, so I think that's a very
important element because it's not, you know, it's not that you aspire to fail, you want, it's actually in retrospect, it's good because it teaches you something, even though I would never want to do every time I can remember them and they were bad, but they were embarrassing. Sure. Like the World Bank one actually made me angry. It was kind of like, what's the deal? Not even a response. You know, and the IMF, but nothing. Mm. It was, one time I started it was more in the background, N.M. Rothschild, which you guys know is a sort of a brokerage boutique bank in the UK. And my professor at Oxford, he was a wonderful professor. And his student was the head of the bank. And the student would ask his professor at times, I need help. Will you help me? So he outsourced it to me and a guy from Arkansas, Bill Halter. And we literally did the analytics on, this is again, before the internet, it was like going to the library, it was on what I don't mean this rudely, so forgive me, but I'd call it irrelevant currencies, right? So the Finnish mark, the Israeli shekel, they were not moving the global markets, but so we would have to write what we think would happen to the currency, right? Wow. And I remember going, wow, this is really fun. And because we said, how could, are they going to pay? And they'd pay us for this, right? We couldn't believe it. But they never let us in front of clients. Right, ever. Right. They never, it was like, you guys just slip the paper through the door. We don't need to see you. but I got a glimpse. I said, that's interesting because I can apply it. And then I remember I was getting rejected or not even responses from anywhere. And I didn't know what to do. And I actually decided that time I didn't really want to be an academic. I think that's an amazing profession, but I didn't feel qualified, actually. Yeah. I just am not someone who's, my math didn't, I didn't feel it was strong enough because economics at some point basically is math.
Yeah.
And I just didn't think it was hard. Like I wasn't in the flow, if you will. I was sort of, I'd work at it. And then I got this letter from McKinsey, and I remember it came in a very unusual envelope, like not a normal, it was in a very unusual envelope, and the printing was so deep and you could feel it. I was like, wow, what the hell is this? And it said, come to a drinks party. We want, you to, and I remember I wasn't going to go because I said, it sounded almost like witchcraft. I was going, this is not, like, I don't know what this is. There's no way that people would pay for that. Like, I thought this is, and then another friend of mine said, look, you should come because there's free alcohol. And, it's a good, there'll be food. It'll be great. Just go. So I went, and it was like a cult because I went and these people would stand up, go, I joined McKinsey 3 years ago. It's the best thing. I remember looking at these people going, oh my God, this is like, this is not what I...
It didn't resonate.
Because it was the first time they were hiring from... They normally want people from the business school, which is still very core and a good thing to do. But they were trying to broaden the net, if you will.
Sure.
And that's where I discovered it. And I remember my first interview, I almost wasn't going to do the second interview because the person I was interviewing with was so arrogant and didn't ask a question. I said, I have no fit with this. Like, I don't know what these guys do, but I don't want to work with this person.
At McKinsey.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And so when the next guy came in, he was an Irishman, an astrophysicist. He came in and I said, listen, his name was Ali Hanna. I said, Ali, it's good to meet you, but I think we should just cut this because I don't think I fit. And he said, what's the problem? I said, I don't fit. I wasn't diplomatic. I just said, I would never want to work with that person. I just, and they probably don't want to work with me. So why don't we just call it a day?
Yeah.
And he said, "Oh, it's interesting, but can I just ask you a couple of questions?" I said, "Sure." And what he did was he subtly did a case study on me. He said, "No, I just want to ask you." And I said, "What?" And he goes, "Well, I'm working for a Swedish steel company, and I'm going." And I said, "Are you serious, or are you BS?" And he goes, "No, I'm serious." And he said, "Okay, and I'm going there tomorrow, and here's what's happening with the company, and you know, what do you think I should say if this is?" And he said, "Okay." And so he took me through a method of just asking, and I said, "Wow, you really do, this is real, right?" He goes, "It's real. I'm telling you, it's real. This is what." And I said, "That's really interesting." And I said, "Is that work you like? Is that work I could do?" And he goes, "Yeah, you. That's what we do. We take young people and we train them up, and that's what you do. You work with these." And I said, "That's what sort of caught me. That guy." And then there was a whole series of other interviews. I remember my mom didn't want me to join McKinsey because she thought it was also some wizardry cultish place that she'd heard about. So when I got the offer, I went to Toronto because you're Canadian, that McKinsey had this view, well, you're Canadian, therefore you should be in Canada. I actually didn't want to be in Canada. But they were like, "That doesn't, you're Canadian, so you go." So I flew there, did these interviews. And I didn't hear from McKinsey for 3 months. I guess it's a bit like the world back. I said, okay, I guess I got something going on here because no one, it's funny, they never responded. And I didn't have the proactiveness to kind of call them up, right? And then I got this phone call and saying, "You know, you're quite rude. You know, we've given you an offer and you don't even want to reply." It was a woman from Brussels. And I went, "I didn't get an offer." She goes, "Yeah, we sent it, right? Because when you finished your interviews, we sent the letter to your mom." And I went, "I never got it." And I said, because I said, "I thought you were rude." Like we had this whole, and it turned out my mom just thought, she literally ripped it up and said, "He doesn't need to do that." And I remember just going, "Wow, mom, you have a lot of power, but that I'd love to at least have a choice." So that's how, and then I loved the work at McKinsey just because it was, at a very young age, you just get dropped in the pool. And I'm not trying to advertise for McKinsey. I think there's a lot of firms that do this. I think, finding a place where you can get stretched, you get feedback, you get training, and you get different experiences. And a very that was just like a kid in a candy store. But it was tough there too because I really liked it. But then I started to go fast through the system mainly because they couldn't believe someone that didn't have a business degree would actually be able to answer, you know what I mean? We had a mini MBA at McKinsey. It was like a 1 month mini MBA. It was brutal. So I went sort of fast early. And then I remember I was put up for partner early. And I remember the feedback came back. "You are so far away from this. It's not even fun. Like, we should never have put you," you know, and it was almost like, I was like, "Wow, whoa, this is." And then I was put up a second time a year later and there's no way this is going to happen. And that was the point. I remember my wife telling me, said, "You know, maybe this isn't the place for you." And I said, "But I love the work." And they said, "Well, you may love the work, but they may not like you." And I was like, "Well, I don't think that's." And I remember she had the prerogative to take the office manager out for breakfast to say, "Listen, don't, you know, this guy is going to just keep going through the wall here. So you need to tell me if there's even a chance. Because if there isn't, you got to tell me so I put the reins on this guy." Luckily, he said, "I think there is a chance, but it won't be easy."
Yeah.
And so it took 3 times to get elected. And that experience wasn't obviously fun. And it was quite humiliating in a way because there were people that joined after I did. One of my very best friends in the world, this guy named Steve Bear, who's from South Africa, he joined after me, but was elected a year before me. And he wanted me to give him his celebration speech. And the thing is, you're doing this in front of an audience of 100 people. And what everyone's actually thinking about is, "Oh, this is awkward." Yeah. Like, so this guy came in before him and he's not, you know, it was kind of, you could feel it. And people like just going, "Oh, this is like, let's get this." And I found that, but in a sense, it was very good because it taught me things don't always work out. You can work as hard and it just doesn't, and you need to deal with it. And you can get mad. That's not going to be help. It taught me a lot of things. And I've remembered that in many different occasions, you know, where I, you know, so, so that was, I'm just giving an example. It was one of many sort of setbacks.
Yeah. I'm just curious, like, when you heard the news that you were elected partner, what, like, how did, what was your, like, initial reaction? Like,
it's just, it's like, it was like, it was like a sucker punch. It was like, oh, like, the air, it was like, then it was kind of like, this is hopefully a dream, like, it's not true. Yeah. I'm going to, like, I had all this, but it was.
Did you go out and celebrate or something? Or?
No, I just kind of, it was a phone call, right? It was a, and it was kind of, and I could tell the guy was very nervous talking. Like, you know, you could, I could tell right from when he started talking to me, this isn't going to, you know what I mean, happen. And yet at the same time, there are other people who are being elected. And it's not a competition. It became, it's not because there's only a few number. It's not that. Everyone can get elected. Mm. It's not. It's just there's a bar. And you have to have demonstrated a certain number. And if you haven't, it, it could be zero partners elected in 1 year. Wow. It could be 20. So it's...
Based on merit.
Yeah, it's just very... So, and that's harder, too, because you can't kind of make an excuse. You can't... It's just I, you know, you weren't, and but in a way, a strange thing. One of my very best, I've had many, many mentors in my career, and one of them came from that. He was actually on the election committee. This guy from LA, and who, for some reason, he didn't know me from Adam, but he obviously was in the room where the election discussion happens. Because in McKinsey, it's not the people that elect you have no idea who you are. Like it's an independent evaluator. Yeah, it's independent evaluator will come in and interview people and say, what's Dom like? Is he, how's he, they look at your record, they, and then they represent your case with a group of six other people that have no idea who you are. So it's all very, it's got to be merit. So he didn't know me, but he, for some reason, liked me. Yeah. I don't, from, and so, you know, 3 years after that, he was the, he went to South Korea and he really wanted me to join him there, even though we didn't really know each other. He said, "I, you need to come and help me." And I did. It was a, so there were many silver linings in this stuff, though it was hard to see at the time.
Yeah.
But there's been many, you know, some issues with, I remember a client I was working with, I had, it was an incredibly good relationship. It was the first time I really had a CEO counseling relationship. And I, cause I was worried, how would that, how old do you have to, do I have to be old to do that? Cause I, believe it or not, at the time looked extremely young. If I showed you photos, Oz has seen them. They, I, you know, it looks like I was 11 years old, and my, I thought, you know, McKinney, you're supposed to counsel partners, and I was like this 11-year-old. And that one story I have to tell you, the, it was actually the CEO of Dial Corporation, which was a big consumer goods company, a bit like P&G. And the guy, they had a bunch of, it was a conglomerate, and they had a, they owned Greyhound bus lines. That was one of them. And we were doing a turnaround. Again, when I, when McKinsey, I thought we were working on the big strategic global issues. And here it was turning around Greyhound bus. It was like, this is not, but anyhow, I loved it because I met with the CEO of that business. And that, but I wanted to see the CEO of Dial Corp. Because I said, you know, what's written on the tin is we serve CEOs. So this Bob Felton, sorry, this, this guy from LA, he wasn't there, but he'd heard, again, had heard about me in the system, told the partner I was with, you should introduce Dom to the CEO. And to cut a long story short, this guy had a grade 8 education.
His, no MBA.
No MBA. Yeah. He had nothing, but he was a very good CEO. And I remember he'd broken his back. So he'd, in, and so he, in the meeting, he was like, he was literally like this, but he was a, like a bodybuilder type, but like this. And I remember, I would cut a long story short, he, I was explaining to him statistical analysis, which he didn't believe in. I mean, no one told me that. So I was explaining to him and I didn't realize he was being sarcastic. Like he would answer, he'd go, oh, really? The law of large number? Very interesting. And I was like, well, this is, I'm having an, and then he went like this and he goes, you, come. And the CFO sitting beside me goes, Dom, when John does that, he's about to fire someone. So good luck. And he took me into the little room and he explained to me, he said, listen, I don't believe in statistics. He goes, how about you talk to the bus drivers? Because the bus drivers probably know how many people are in the bus. Have you thought about that rather than counting? And I said, well, I did. He goes, talk to the bus driver. He had this. And then he said, you know, I have grade 8 education. And he goes, because my, his parents died in a fire and he was the only, he had to take care of his two siblings and the back, broken back came from that fire. You know, it's all a long, but he's sort of a self-made. And he was the guy too, said, do not judge people, but I get the sense from you that you're a little bit arrogant and think because of your background, you know, and you know, I respect it, but that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for business judgment. And I don't think you have any. I remember it was like, well, and so it became a tradition. I would see him.
Yeah.
And one of the meetings I remember, I'll never forget it. He said, look, I'm going to have a barbecue this weekend and I'd like you to come. And there's this notion of CEOs having a kitchen cabinet. So I thought, right, like,
you're part of it.
Yeah. Man, I'm in the kitchen cabinet. And I think he could see. And I was like, so you want me at the, he goes, yeah. And I said, who will be there? And he goes, the CFO, the general counsel, two board members and you. And I was like, wow. And he could see and he goes, yeah. And I said, wow, you can, he goes, yeah, I'm inviting you because my babysitter's sick. Okay, I got it. So it was I met so many different characters that way that you could learn from. And also their experiences, what went well and what didn't.
It's very interesting you say about the whole, the guy who, he didn't have an MBA,
yeah.
but he was running such a successful,
yeah.
is that something you've noticed as well? Like where, I've seen you talk before about like challenging orthodoxy,
yeah.
or challenging
yeah.
kind of conventional thinking. And I believe you were like one of the first ones to like appoint someone in McKinsey who didn't have a degree.
Yeah, what I was trying to do is, when I was leading McKinsey, what I realized quickly is we are very good at telling other people what to do, but don't want to take our own medicine, right? It was amazing. Like, let's do a strategy. That doesn't work in a partner. You know, every time it would be like, oh, you can't do that. So what I said, we're going to challenge every orthodoxy except our values. Our values are sacred and they remain timeless, but who we work with, how we work with them, how we're paid, the talent, we have to challenge that. It doesn't mean we do it. But the last one I challenged, there were about eight of these that I was doing, was actually on who we hire. Mm. Because, and what I said is, I want us to hire people without a university degree. And that almost caused a riot because people are like, how can you, you know, and I'm obviously a believer in education.
Yeah.
I think that's fundamental. But there are people who are exceptionally talented that for whatever reason don't have a degree. And so we hired six people that year, my last year, with no university degree. And I'm happy three of them are now partners.
Wow.
In the firm, right? And they're just different backgrounds and where they are. But I think we hired a lot of people from the military who'd come in to make it. We'd hire, you know, a lot of the McKinsey people in the 1950s were actually from the Navy. John Katzenbach, Ron Daniels, because there's places that, we're looking for places that build leaders, if you will, in different ways. We have people, Jesuits.
Mm.
We have a lot, there's a lot of Jesuits. In
really?
Yeah, I'm just saying it.
Yeah.
In fact, some people have tried to insult me, which for good reason, but one said, you guys are the Jesuits of capitalism. I said, I like that, actually. That's not an insult. Like, that's a good, we're that way. But I think that bringing people, you know, it's not, don't assess people by just the degree. There's got to be more to the character of the person. And
It's hard skills and soft skills.
Exactly, yeah.
And do you think, like, in the world where moving towards, like particularly with AI and all that, the soft skills will actually become more important than the hard skills?
I think one of the biggest, I think there's so many changes, and I think you guys are going to be leading in literally the most interesting time in history, I think, just given the amount of change that's going on. Any one of the major forces that are underway now, I think, would make this next 20 years incredible. And I'm optimist, by the way. I'm a frightened optimist is how I put it, you know what I mean? But the AI, the energy transition, the geopolitical shifts that are going on, the societal shifts, the income inequality, there's a lot of really hardcore change that's underway. And I think what I want to get to is, I'm being too long-winded, is there's less and less of a playbook to work with.
Mm.
There's a guy, Howard Marks, who used to run Oak Tree Capital, who's worth reading. He's a very thoughtful guy. And he basically said, you know, in the 1970s and the 1980s, there were a lot of things that you were working within a fixed system, exchange rates, you know, interest rates, geopolitical stability or not. Like, there was a lot of things you could just assume were fixed and then take a line off that and work it. And basically, he was saying at the end of the 1990s, 90% of those started to fall away. So we have less structure, which makes it more important for creative thinking, values, you know, intuition. I do think creativity, that's going to be critical. It doesn't mean you don't need to have rigor, but I think there'll be more of that. And that's why it's interesting. I think philosophy is actually it's a course I wish I'd taken more of. I thought it was too difficult for me. I didn't think I'd get good enough marks on it, so I stayed away from. But it's something that I'm very interested in now. And interestingly, when MOOCs first came out, those massive online courses, a lot of CEOs took those without people knowing. And you know what the most frequent, the most interesting topic was for people was philosophy. A lot of those CEOs were doing philosophy because it's about how do you make a right versus right decision? How do you logically think about something that you hasn't been thought about before? So I do think those soft skills are going to be critical, and again, the creativity and the learning. I think there's so many orthodoxies we have now that are going to be gone, that we have to, the continuous learning, I think, is lifelong learning.
Yeah. I'll ask one last question, and then we'll go to questions. So when you think about AI and the effect that's going to have on the future of work, there's many young professionals here, people very kind of earlier on in their career, future leaders, basically.
Yeah.
And a lot of people here might be thinking about, like, maybe they want to a career transition, or like my parents' generation was like, they pick a company, they stay there for like 40, 50 years, and then they retire.
Yeah.
How do you think about kind of the future of work, and how would you be thinking about kind of how to navigate that?
Yeah. I first of all, I think there's something about it's hard because everyone has worries about you need a job, you need income, you want some stability, and so you got to find kind of what's there in a sense. But I think it's really important. You got to look for something that where you're excited and you run to work every day. And as I said, academically, I wouldn't have run to work every day. I just wasn't good enough to be it. But in the McKinsey side, the danger is I'd work all the time because I love the, and everyone picks their own, can be medicine. You know, you have your, there's different, it's finding that link between your passion and a place to do it. And I actually believe with the technology changes now, people can have more agency in defining what it is that they like than they've had in the past, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But it means you have to take risk. The other story I'll say, then I'll shut up on this. I remember having to do it was a presentation to the mayor of Beijing. He had this advisory board, and China was trying to build the sort of services economy. And instead of doing a presentation, what I did was brought in the New York Yellow Pages, which literally was about this high off the ground. And I brought in the Beijing Yellow Pages, which was about that big.
Yeah.
And I just put the two together and I said, that's the service economy, right? It's that's, and I said, the thing about the service economy is you can't tell it what, it's just, it's the market.
Mm.
And I asked the mayor, I said, open up Manhattan, and just put your finger in it. Let's tell us what it is. And it was a business to repair 1956 Cadillac wings.
Wow.
That was the business, right? And I said, I bet you that didn't come up in the 10th five-year plan, right? I'm a big fan of the plans, by the way. So it was just, and I think what's going to happen, I do not subscribe to the view that AI is going to eliminate jobs, and it will eliminate some, that we're going to have net no job. I just don't buy that at all. I think we find it very hard as humans to think exponentially.
Yeah.
In 1986, when I joined McKinsey, the idea that there would be an iPhone, I would have literally taken you to the mental institution. I said, you're out of here. Like, there's no, this, so we are, humans are, I think it's going to unleash an amazing number of, you know, things. And again, you want to think about it, but I think it's what gets you excited. But I think it's going to give opportunities to be more, you know, for you to kind of build it, build sure. what you want to build and drive. Because we're seeing now some very large companies built with two or three people.
Yeah.
You know, it's shocking yeah. to me.
I remember seeing somewhere that like we might start seeing like one person billion-dollar companies.
Yeah,
like
totally.
Which you can see how it could, yeah. could start to unfold.
And that's where I think, by the way, things like it was Henry Kissinger who said it. Unfortunately, our philosophy is not keeping up with the technology. And again, that's why I'm fascinated with history. But we haven't. You know, in all of the, if I think about 1776, which was a pretty, that was probably a time in the terms of change. Yeah. If you think of what was going on, economic thinking, philosophical thinking, the establishment of the United States, there was the French Revolution. There was mm-hmm. a hell of a lot of stuff going on. But there was a lot of philosophy being written about how to interpret the world, it was a very male, like what's the man's role in sure. society? We don't really have that now.
Yeah.
And we need it because, you know, it's great on the one hand to have a one-person billion-dollar company, but can we have a society where there's 15 people that have 50% of the world's wealth? I'm a capitalist, by the way. I'm all for, but you then have to start.
It's also about the societal.
It's the societal part. And if you go back to Adam Smith, you know, people forget. They think about the Wealth of Nations. The first book he wrote was The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And in that book, one of the lines he says, it's the duty of the entrepreneur to take care of the society in which they operate. It was a pretty socialist bit of thinking from the invisible hand. And I'm saying they're not contradictory. But we need that thinking, because right now we're hurtling into a system. Even, you know, Singapore is a place I long admired Singapore, and I had a chance actually to work with Lee Kuan Yew. Mm. Right, it's toward the end. I can tell you a story of that too, where he put me in my place and stuff. But that I remember talking to the cabinet secretary there, a guy named Leo Yip. This is probably 5 years ago after I was leaving China, because I was trying to get career advice.
Yeah, his surname is actually Yip.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Do you know, are you related? Oh, yeah, good. Okay, yeah. But Leo, no, he's an amazing guy. But he basically, I said, you know, I'm thinking about going back into government. The prime minister wants me to play a bigger role, and I'm interested. And he basically said, don't do it. And I was like, whoa, what? That's insult. Like, why would you say it? And he said, because I don't think you're going to be able to accomplish what you want, because there's so many issues. Mm. There's just issue after issue. You think it's some stable, it's not. I know you're going to, therefore I know you'll be frustrated. And I said, okay, well, what are you thinking about? And I said, is it the China-US relationship? And he looked at me with some disdain, right? Almost like, are you kidding me? And he goes, that's obvious. He goes, no, what I'm focused on is there a role for the nation state? Because with technology companies, people can have more affinity to Meta than they can have to a country. And that's what we have to deal with. Like, what is our value proposition to our citizens versus a technology company?
Yeah.
Because we're 5.5 million people. It's just again, I was going, whoa, what? Because, Dom, nation states haven't been around forever. They're a relatively recent phenomenon. So you need to think about it. And that's, again, where I think this is going to be really an exciting time.
So you're optimistic.
I'm a frightened optimist.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, great. So let's do some questions. So Corrado, I know you had some.
Okay. First of all, thank you so much, Mr. Barton. Very interesting. Talking about change, I would like to connect myself to the geopolitical change that you mentioned before. How do you think the transition from what can be considered a market-driven economy to a geopolitical-driven economy will impact the consulting and the industry in the coming years? And how do you think this can adapt?
Yeah, I think it's going to change a lot, but on some elements it won't. Because I think, you know, as I said, in 1986, geopolitics wasn't... There was a Cold War, if you will, but there was a stability, and you kind of knew that you could operate within that environment. It was almost pretty stable. 89, when the wall fell, it was kind of like, now there's one system. It just wasn't really a factor. Geopolitics was more like an after dinner speech at a board. Let's have an ex ambassador, someone give a talk, and that's interesting. Let's get back to work. now geopolitics is as important as marketing, HR, it's core to strategy. So it's now embedded, and you see a massive growth in geopolitical advisory firms. You know, I'm involved with one, Eurasia Group, right? Ian Bremmer set up. And what I like about them is they're very analytically driven. They look at the micro and they give probabilities of what they would think happens. A lot of geopolitical are, you have former, you know, leaders and so to come in and provide judgment, which is helpful too, but this is the analyst. So you've seen a massive growth, and that's going to continue because you need to bake it into the strategy. It's not, let's do a strategy and then test it with the geopolitics has to be part of it. Like supply chains, right? Your organization structure, you know, where you put your data, where you hire your people, what markets you serve, you know, these are all, you have to think about that. And that's why it's a big challenge for Rio Tinto, because we're a global company, but MNCs are not that exciting anymore. You know, people now, it's, what are you going to do for me? So with President Trump, it's literally, you could be our Exxon. We'd like you to be our Exxon. You know, we've got, Canada wants us to do that. Australia wants us to do that. So everyone wants us to be there, but that's, we're global. You know what I mean? So how do we... And by the way, our biggest market's China. And you know, you can't, and that's the case for all. So how do we manage that, right? So it's going to be a very, it's an important part of it. But it's like technology, you know, it used to be technology was a factor. It's now a major piece. So that also, like geopolitics has to be, everyone has to be a technology company. A mining company has to be a technology. And you better figure it out. How it's going to work, or someone's going to figure it out for you and disrupt you. So that, and I just think the biggest change is probably the speed with which all this happens. You know, the average lifetime of a company, of an S&P 500 company in 1935 was 91 years, I think it was. Today it's 15. Yeah. So the churn rate because of all is there. And if you don't, and when I grew up, you know, there was companies like GE, which I still, by the way, have a lot of respect for, but I could list you. There's a lot of them are no longer, right? They're gone. And it's shocking to me, right? But this is, and that's why I think even, I don't want to say, you know, Apple, Meta, they're great, but I'd be very surprised if in 25 years, there's a completely different set of seven that look at Apple and others like there has been. So I'm not trying to make it. I'm just be ready for that.
Because of time, we'll basically
take a bunch
group,
of, yeah,
yeah,
good,
group
yeah.
them together.
Yeah.
We'll
go, yeah, I'm going to write. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I was hoping to draw upon your ambassador geopolitical experience, something that's been discussed in the UK now, especially since 2016, at least in academic circles, is a potential Kanzak union of some sort. Something I've been looking at personally is on how the four countries could unlock their investment management industry and the capital markets to allow the really vibrant sort of AI sectors, technological sectors. And
which country? Which were you saying?
Kanzak, so Canada, okay. Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. But I was hoping, based on your ambassador experience.
I hadn't heard that. That's a good one. Kanzak, okay. Yeah. yeah. Okay,
it's
yeah.
It's quite discussed in academic circles at the moment. But what... Is there a roadmap in which the four countries could build a strategic path to certainly let their economies be prosperous and ensure their supply chains with the big blocks near them are also remain functioning?
And
excellent.
Okay. Yeah.
Firstly, thank you very much. It's an excellent talk. I very much appreciate it. I've got two practical questions. Firstly, in life, there are a lot of setbacks and a lot of injustice, at least, you know, the way you yourself perceive it. So the first thing was, you know, having to raise the funds for university, even though you're a very capable candidate, where other people just sort of naturally just cruised right into the academic course. And the second one, in your case, you mentioned was the McKinsey, when other people, they got their partnerships and you had to sort of, you know, hang around.
Yeah.
At the moment, that feels really unjust. We say that I'm really capable person, why aren't you pushing my career? So how do you sort of deal with that, plus the emotions and then practically? And the second thing you've mentioned is that you've had really amazing mentors during your journey on the way. And my question is, how did you sort of select them? Did you put yourself in particular places in order to, you know, meet such people? How do you do this, and how do you advise us? But thank you very much.
No,
thank you. Maybe we'll take one or two more, but keep it short and simple, please. Yeah.
I was very impressed with Carney's speech at Davos. So I was wondering what you thought about kind of middle powers, because of the stability they build from actually like going for norms and building norms, whether they're going to be driving the next however many years.
Right.
Yep, Pat?
So the question is, you spend most of your time in the business world, and you take on a political job in 2019. So I was wondering, how and why did you get the job, and are there anything surprising that you found, and particularly because that was at the lowest point of the China-Canadian relationship, so I wonder if there are any most memorable event or experience that you had during that period.
Cool.
Okay, we'll go quickly. Yeah, and I might combine the first and the third, the Kanzak, or you call it that, and the Carney, because I think they're very related in a sense, right? So I actually think there's a lot that can be done that way. And again, to me, it's part of the challenging the orthodoxies of thinking. We have to think differently about how things work. And I'll just give you one story on this. When I was working in Australia, it was 1989. I got to work with a guy named Paul Keating, who was he later became the prime minister. He was the treasurer at the time, one of the most inspiring political leaders I've met. By the way, no university education, taught by a labor leader, but did probably some of the most aggressive economic reforms of any treasurer, if you could, certainly in Australia. He did the tax reform that led to the superannuation programs, which is why Australia has one of the largest capital markets in the world. At one dinner we had, the first dinner he told me, and we were drinking quite a lot of red wine, I remember the time, and he looked at me and he goes, if you have half a brain, you should move to Asia. Mm-hmm. At first I was going, I don't appreciate having half a brain. Like, and then he said, Australians need to travel to Asia, not just to Europe. That's because that's where the trade is going to be. And the second dinner we had, there were four of them, but the second dinner, it was very late. And he said, I think we should merge Canada, Australia, and Ireland into one country. And I was so excited and probably drank so much that I called that night. It was like 11 o'clock at night. I called the managing director of McKinsey, Fred Gluck, who's a good friend to this day, because Fred was a very ideas guy. And he said, any ideas you have, and if you don't think they're getting through, call me. I was a very junior, I was an engagement manager. So I called him. And, you know, the secretary said, you know, who are you? And I said, Dominic Barton. I said, because what do you want? Because Fred said, if you have ideas, you should call. And he said, so he gets on the phone. He goes, Dominic Barton. He goes, you don't sound Australian. I said, I'm on this exchange program, you know. And he goes, well, what's your idea? I said, I have an idea, which is from Paul Keating, but I think it's a good one. We should merge Canada, Australia, and Ireland. And I remember the phone was silent. And then he said, he goes, what's your name again?
Yeah.
And at that point, I was going to give my best friend's name. I thought, this doesn't sound, I could feel it again over the, and then he said, you know what? He goes, I think it's a really interesting idea. And I suggest you leave McKinsey and pursue it. But I think there's a lot because you need scale, right? To be able to, and you need markets and you need, there's the security of the supply. And I think the cultures are very similar and complementary. I would even think about India in that notion. You know what I mean? It's not, and I would just be careful you don't try and become a bloc, because I don't think anyone, I think China and the US are the big boys on the block, and that's how it's going to, and India may get there. I think they will, but it'll take longer than we think, if you will. But that, and there's something about military power. The Canadian military is just not, they're not going to be doing, and the UK military, which is, I think, it's just not in that, you know what I mean? And that's a very difficult thing to deal with, if you will. But that said, I think there's a lot of things that can be done in the scaled business development, as you said, startups, doing things that will be able to, not everything has to go to the Silicon Valley, which is, we have a huge number of startups in Canada, in Australia, actually in New Zealand, but 90% of them end up in the Silicon Valley because that's where the capital is. And I think you could, Canada and Australia have some of the largest pension funds in the world. They actually could, you could do something. So I think that's, I just came from a Commonwealth conference before here, right, where, you know, people were talking about how, are there more things we can do in the Commonwealth? Though Saudi Arabia was there, and I can't remember, and a French West African country that's not part of that was there anyhow. So I do think we're going to start to see some changes that way. And a big instigator of that's actually Singapore. Sorry, I keep looking at you on that, but setbacks. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard because you have to deal with the emotion first. And I think we all take it like I actually believe most people are insecure. And therefore something like that happening just fuels the fire. Like I was lucky. You look at things that happened and you go, I was just lucky. And now finally someone's figured out that I'm actually not that good. And you can start to spin into out of control because you're just, and that's why I think it's very important to try and have balance in the sense of, I always felt it's like a three-legged stool. There's got to be something that's giving you a positive sense. It may not be your work. It may be your family. It may be friends. It may be a sport. It may be not a hobby, but maybe a spiritual thing that you. Yeah. But if you just are only reliant on that, that's when you get vulnerable, right? And I think I found I could deal with the setbacks better when I had another leg to kind of go to and go, well, that hasn't worked so well, but I feel really good about this part. That's probably not a very sophisticated way, but that's sort of how I would do it. And I think it's also important to know that's where it ties in with the mentors, because every mentor I have met and mentors are typically, they've done things, they've always had many challenges. And some, when I hear of some of the challenges they've had, my challenges pale in convention to some of the setbacks. Again, I think about that John Teats guy. Imagine his parents dying in a fire, and all of a sudden, you there's no more school. There's no one. He had no other family around. It's kind of like, I got to now, at grade eight, get a job. I got to support my, there's no just, there's no fairness. I find that inspired. It definitely twisted him. I would tease him, not carefully, because he is such a big guy. But so I think you can learn from those things. And I think the thing is just to stay with it. Do not give up no matter where it is, and look for someone you can talk to. That Steve Baer, the guy who I introduced as a partner when I wasn't a partner, again, we're very close friends to this day. We later on would have every 6 months, we would rent a hotel room. People thought we were a bit bizarre because it would just be the two of us. But we were, the two of us would, and we would literally spend the day talking about what was exciting us, what was frustrating us, what did we want to do? Like we helped each other. We talked about, we could be open. This hasn't gone well. And that was incredibly important. Like as having a friend, you know what I mean? That you could really lean on. I think the hardest is when you're lonely and you just have the one thing, then it's difficult.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate that.
Yeah. And then, sorry, I can't even mean where I read my own writing. The political job. Yeah. Sorry. So I was always interested in the public sector. It's cause, but I did bits of things on the edge. So one thing I felt strongly about is whatever, because I moved around a lot, I wanted to play a role in the city or the country that I was living in, right? It's important, I think, you give back. That's just something, maybe it was my parents or it was something, but you should always be giving back. You should be part of the community. You can't be a giver, not a taker. That was important view of me. And so I would, when I was in Canada, I did that. It was more like there was like a banking review commission, which I did voluntarily, right? Just, it wasn't a, you know, but there was a civil servant who was leading it and wanted people to play a role. When I was in South Korea, the mayor, you know, had a program for the city of Seoul, how to make it a more global city. And so I volunteered to just work with him and a bunch of other MNCs that were there. And then when he became the president, I helped him. We did literally like a 100-year strategy for South Korea, right? It was just, and he was amazing. And we brought investors in. We were looking at how to change the education system. And it was public sector, but I was advisor, not in it. And I could, Singapore, I did a lot with the EDB, the Economic Development Board. I was on that board for 15 years. I did a lot of things in Singapore. So that was just a thing in Canada, because I hadn't been in Canada, but I felt very linked and strongly, proudly. There was a Canadian Growth Council, which the Prime Minister wanted to look at how to increase the growth rate. So I did that. But they were all part-time. And the reason I say this is because I always had this interest, but I didn't know how to express it or do it. And then what happened was this relationship between Canada and China really went into the ditch very badly. And it had been very good. And it just all of a sudden completely transformed. And the cabinet secretary and the prime minister knew I'd had a lot of experience in China and we needed a different approach. And it probably needed someone who wasn't a career diplomat, someone to come, because it was a problem that had to be fixed. Actually, Oz wasn't, that's how we first met each other. He was working in the government, working in the prime minister's office and the foreign affairs, like in different groups. And so I wasn't sure I wanted to do it because a lot of my very close friends have said, you should not do it. Like you're an idiot because first of all, you're not going to be able to solve it. It's a geopolitical issue. You don't really, with all respect, you don't know much about that and you're going to ruin your reputation. You know, why would you do that? And you're probably being offered it because no one else wants to do it. You know what I mean? It was these are good friends, but they tell you stuff that, you know, but to me, there was something I found in my career when people tell me I can't do something, it's for a bizarre reason, excites me. It actually motivates me even more. Like people would tell me, you shouldn't, losers go to South Korea. I'll be very, like that office is a complete basket case. You should not, that actually excited. That's the worst thing you could say if you're trying to convince me. So this, I started getting more excited, the more risky it got in a strange way. And then I think I loved it. It was very difficult because I did realize I didn't know things I thought I knew. I thought I knew how to negotiate because I'd negotiated for companies. I'd done M&A, big M&A. Honestly, I found it insulting when people would say, well, I don't think you know how to negotiate. I said, what are you talking about? That's what I do. And I remember I got my head handed to me in the first, we had a sort of like a back channel meeting before things were official. And I just got completely mincemeated by the Chinese. He was the former U.S. ambassador, the Chinese U.S. ambassador. He was like 75 years old, and he just took me to the tool shed. And I remember the guy, he's now the Prime Minister Mark Carney's key security, national security advisor, David Morrison. We didn't know each other when I came in. And before we went into this first meeting, we're in this secret room, right? Every embassy has it, so no one can listen. It's like a refrigerator. And there were all these phones. I didn't know how they worked. And David Morrison was saying, we were talking to the prime minister, and the prime minister was saying, well, how do you think it'll go? And I didn't know how to work the phones. I thought, you know, he should be asking me. I'm the one that, and David sort of picked, and he goes, 70% chance it'll be a failure, 20% chance it's a horrendous failure, 10% chance. And I was trying to pick up the phone, like, shut up. Like, that's wrong. Like, what are you, like, and I couldn't figure out where it was. And we go into this meeting. And honestly, it was a bad meeting because I didn't understand the protocols. And this guy was, part of it was an act, but they were so angry and they hadn't had a chance to express that and they needed to. And I was on the receive, and I didn't realize that I thought, you know, I'm someone who spent a lot of time in China. I have a lot of serious relationships in China. It was like, you have a diplomatic hat on. And it got so bad, I had to literally cut the meeting and say, can we just take a tea break? Right? And we went in and I said, David, what's going on? And David just said, this is probably the worst meeting I have ever been in my life. He goes, we're beyond the 20% horrible. Like, we're in the really, you set us back. I remember like, well, that. So anyhow, it was I loved working with the people, the public service, both in China, the Canadian, and in Ottawa. It was amazing because they were really talented people with deep seated commit. Like, they were there to serve the country. Like that, I really, that's different than what I felt business people. And I've seen people that are, but this was a different thing. People were there. They were proud of what they were doing. They were very agile. They weren't sort of bureaucrats, civil servants that don't, these guys would move. What I did find is there, many people were risk averse. Like, if I would come up with a creative idea, people would just go, well, you can't. And that actually has excited me. So we would try that. And poor Oz knows some of the phone calls we would have and I would go to the wall on it.
As someone with a front row seat to this, Don's being very modest. I mean, Don, you know, you did have this impossible task. But if there's one person who, I mean, this was basically like a tit for tat holding people, you know, springing out. But Don, you really, you worked a miracle then.
No, but it was... But I think the thing was, that's where problem solving comes, like you learn, and again, it wasn't McKinsey, I think you learn that in business. It was, what I was thinking is we have a very difficult problem here, which is we have a Venn diagram that you have to find the overlap in. So we had, Canada has interests, and the Prime Minister was very clear to me what the red lines were. I mean, that was unbelievable task directedness. I've never forgotten that conversation. Everything else was open, but he said, I have two red lines and you will never, I will fire you if you break these red lines. The United States had red lines. China had red lines and Huawei had red lines. So there were four groups that are there and you had to find that, and there was an overlap and it was a very pin sized, but we found it. And then it was to figure out how to build the trust that we could, that everyone would be comfortable with that solution. Because actually none of the four were comfortable. Even my government said, this is BS. It's not, you can't, the Chinese were like, we think it could work, but none of these other guys would ever think it would. You know what I mean? So it was, how do you build trust? And you don't have a lot of time, because what was tough there is there are people in detention, people in prison, and that's very tough because I would see them. So every day we took longer, these people were in pain. Yeah. And by the way, so was, from a Chinese point of view, their person was also in pain. If you like, it was, people were getting angrier. Like it was getting angrier. But the thing about it for me, like one of the person who is the key person to negotiate with at the end, the direct person, was a guy named Xie Feng, who's now the U.S. the Chinese ambassador to the U.S. And if I had another child, he'd be the godfather, even though we were on the opposite sides, like we were. And it got very antagonistic. At the end of the day, there was a trust level. So it may seem like a strange thing. You can be an adversary, but you can trust each other. And there were, at the end, some decisions that had to be made where he basically said, if this doesn't work out, I remember him telling me, he goes, the consequences for me are more severe, if you get my drift, than for you. And I said, you know, that may be true from how you think about it, but let me tell you about both of us kind of jumped off the cliff, if you will, and that builds a bond. As I said, honestly, even though we were adversaries, if I did have another child at the time, I would have had him be the godfather, because it was just, there's a trust level to the, even though we have different views, you can. And so it was an amazing experience. It was a tough experience, and the hardest part was, it felt like doing anything else after that was it's just like, wow, I'm okay. This isn't the same. It's not got the same edge, if you will. But I also don't think that would have been sustainable. I think I would have been done if I did one more. There are people that do that. In the US, one of the guys we dealt with, Robert O'Brien, who was the national security advisor, he was the official hostage negotiator for the United States. I didn't even know they had that. But they've got it's an ambassador role. And what they do is basically focus on US hostages. And I remember it was President Trump term one, because he literally grabbed this guy and said, this guy's 39-0. Like he's got 39 out, like 0-0. And he's going to help you, right? There was the election, Trump was out, Biden. So we had, all of a sudden, it was a new crew to deal with. But the people you meet, the experience. So it was a wonderful experience. I would do it again, but there were parts of it. There were parts that are still deeply emotional.
I want to be respectful of your time.
Sure, yeah.
So for everyone, all the Netherhall residents, we're going to have dinner at the usual time. And then everyone else, we'll take a group picture and then kind of go from there. So thank you very much.
No, thank you. We
also want to give you a Netherhall house tie.
Very nice. Wow.
And
oops, sorry.
And these are Netherhall cufflinks.
Very nice. Wow.
So thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.